We'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to call the Annexation Zoning Committee meeting to order. It's 5:10. And we have present Katie Capellini, committee members Katie Capellini, Sandy Hussman, Mark Lukey, and Doug Hanem, the chair. We also have council members, Mark Frye with us. There's only five of us, huh? Right. And the mayor's here, law director. We have Randy Milnick here to help us with one of our topics, Kevin Aller. And we also have with us Bob Hinterleiter from Planet Aid, who I've met with, and he will be addressing one of the topics. We really have a couple of issues on the agenda tonight. And the reason, the original reason that we scheduled this meeting was to talk about our design standards, and we're going to kick that meeting off. We're also going to talk a bit today about charity huts and donation bins, different, they come under different terminology. We've had some email exchange on that. I think Kevin would like to talk briefly about our new zoning fees, briefly. And the last one, we're going to talk for just a few minutes, introduce an issue that we have about satellite dishes. That will be brief, but let's start, let's jump right in first with the design standards issue. This came up, most of you will recall, this came up because as part of our effort to secure some grants, we quickly moved forward to adopt some specific guidelines regarding historical buildings and historic preservation designs. In the process of doing that, what we uncovered was that we really had three separate sections of our code that addressed building design standards. And one of the things we talked about when we adopted these back in June was that we would work to combine the requirements of the new historic code section, which is in chapter 1152, with the standards in 1187 and 1151 for our downtown overlay district, so that hopefully we could have a single set of design standards going forward, so that somebody wanted to build something in the city of Sylvania to go to a single section of the code and understand what our requirements would be. I will say that after it didn't take very long for me to read sections 1152, 1151, and 1187 to decide that this is something that I was not going to be able to undertake independently. And talking with Leslie, with our law director, we also thought that that was probably more of an undertaking than we could handle in-house. And that's why we asked Randy Milnick from Pogemeyer to be here today. He has helped us, you'll recall, with a land use plan, with the rewrite of our zoning code. And in fact, Randy has historically shared with us some other thoughts about design standards. which I managed to dig out over the course of the weekend. So it seemed like at the end of the day, we would need some outside help in terms of drafting a single set of design standards. And with the law director's blessing and participation, we invited Randy to be here tonight. With that, Leslie, do you have anything you want to add to that introduction?
No, Doug, I think you, Mr. Hanum, I think you did a good job of summarizing the process and where we are right now. And you're correct. This is beyond my, Mr. Milneck has much more access and awareness of ongoing zoning issues than I do on a day-to-day basis.
And you've got some other things to attend to, too.
A few. And I think he can give us some good guidance and direction on how to combine the three chapters into one cohesive, comprehensive, good resource for anyone who's looking to build or renovate anything in our city.
Okay, so I think we just were handed a handout. Is this from you, Randy? You want to, well, you're here. We might as well put you to work.
Sure.
Tell us what your current thoughts are.
Well, you'll see attached here a document that looks like this. It says Sylvania Zoning Design Review Issues across the top. And I guess, first of all, it's been a little while since we've been here working on your zoning code. But in going back and looking at the website, we did discover a few issues in there that need to be addressed in terms of some overlap and perhaps some misrepresentations of how the code is aligned. So I drew attention to that, and that's on the first page. First of all, the complete planning and zoning code is not really the sum total of everything you see below it, which is something it should be, I would imagine. It's a prior draft, and I'm sure it wasn't updated in the past, so that's something that needs to be done. There's a district that's missing, and then also some districts that are misnamed, I think. So just a little cleanup in there would help address that and help us launch into a larger effort to address these three conflicting elements of design review. And as you know, I think from those of you who participated last time in this, we uncovered some of the issues that we're dealing with today. And that has to do with a separate document called the Sylvania Design Guidelines. It looks like this. It's referenced in the existing design guidelines. It's somewhat dated. It's 1995 and includes a lot of good information in there, but perhaps needs to be updated. So I would introduce that as a topic for conversation along with fixing the actual ordinance itself, which again is confusing, I think, and it's important obviously to have the requirements clear and direct. And you know, I think just to summarize too, the fact when we talk about design guidelines, your typical zoning code is talking about what you can't do. You know, it says you can't go closer than so many feet to the walls or the lot lines. You can't have it so tall. You can't do, you have to have so much parking. The design guidelines are more prescriptive in terms of saying what you want to have happen. And you've had some other planning take place, the downtown planning that took place, where we took a lot of images and graphics and kind of showed what downtown could look like, particularly north of Maplewood. We spent some time there. I know there's also been separate efforts going on with SOMA when you had JJR with some massing and actually some market studies that were done to support what could happen there. So there's some images of what you hope downtown eventually becomes, but we need to really blend that into your zoning ordinance so that the ordinance speaks to those images and visions of what you want to have happen. So happy to try to answer questions. Or
yeah, I guess you know what we currently have is we do have at least three separate sets of standards. Now we have these historic design standards. We have the downtown design standards, and I'm leaving one out. 1152.
The overlay districts.
Yeah, the overlay districts. So what I envisioned was maybe combining 1151, 1152, 1187. And I'm not sure that there are specific, are there restrictions in 1150 as well? I'm not really, I hadn't focused on those, if there are. Because you're right, they're not, I was focusing, I have long ago lost track of my big book, and I go online to look at the ordinances. So, because I'm not very good at filing the changes on an annual basis, but I rely on the website. But are there restrictions in 1152?
No, I don't believe there are. I think 1151 was a downtown overlay district,
right,
which was originally set to be kind of a companion to the neighborhood conservation district that was set up for the older residential areas that are to the north,
right,
and west of downtown. So the thinking was that all of the design review would ultimately fall under the overlay district for downtown. And that's the way I recall it from several years ago, that we would be collapsing essentially what is 1187,
right,
and the new material that you just adopted into an overlay district applicable to downtown.
And is that, I think that's right. That's what I had envisioned us doing. Randy, your thoughts about how we would best go about that process? I mean, we have two sets of standards. I think they're, I don't know. It's been a while since I've been through them all in detail, but I don't think they clash so much as they apply to different things in different areas, if I recall correctly.
Right. The 1187, the existing architectural district's material, is what references your 1995 guidelines.
Right. So if we took the, is it reasonable to think that we can come up with a single set of guidelines that we can adopt, and do we adopt those within the code, or do we adopt them separately and refer to them in the code?
As it's currently set up, you're adopting them in the ordinance and referencing this document.
And I think that's probably a better way to do it.
That's the common way of doing that among in communities, to have, because the guidelines are more of a cookbook, so to speak, in terms of these are the design elements we want to see in our downtown. Not all of them may be applicable to every project, but this is like a color palette. This is like a palette of materials that we want to see in buildings. This is site design issues we want to see. It's really, it becomes more subjective than the hard specific numbers that are often in the zoning code that say that so many parking spaces, so much setback, so much square feet, so much building mass, all the numerical things. This gets more to the design issues.
Kevin, I know you oversee the the implementation of this. Is this a do you have any thoughts as we start down this process about how we ought to go about doing this?
No, I think, you know, and everything is, it can change tomorrow, but I think with the personnel that we have on board today, I'm more comfortable with situations where a more building standards, if we have to kind of regulate those well or supervise, I would rather say than regulate. I'm comfortable with doing that today. I can change tomorrow with changing personnel, who knows, but
yeah.
I think it's the path that we're going down. The three different sections, I agree, is confusing. What applies where and that kind of stuff. So I think if we can group it, if you will, or make them mesh together in a better fashion, I think that's a lot.
My my ultimate vision here would be to get a single set of guidelines, a single set of defined standards that would ultimately be reviewed by the Architectural Review Board so that we have that direct input to make sure that they're being implemented properly. You know, having been through that process with our, when I was on the Planning Commission, the Architectural Review Board, having been through that with the some of the downtown development, particularly the hotel and some of the other buildings, that was a very, I was very comfortable with that process, and I think it gave us a good result. So ultimately, that's the kind of approach that I have in mind, and that's consistent. Is that consistent with what you think we can do here? Okay. Well, any members of the committee have any specific observations? Because I think what we're going to end up doing here is commissioning Randy to go off and do some drafting and bring something back to us to look at.
Mark? The only question I have, and this is kind of way off the wall, is is there any overlap or connection with our CRA districts and those regulations with this? I mean, are that two separate things?
It's not necessarily, I mean, actually, the boundaries, when we're done here, it would be very interesting, I think, to think about merging those CRA boundaries to some extent with the boundaries of our overlay district.
That's kind of what I was thinking, if there's an opportunity for some alignment there. Because I think your point, Doug, overall is to eliminate as much confusion as possible or duplication as possible. So maybe, if it's appropriate, fold that into the discussion as well.
Right. At the end of the day, what I would like to be is as development-friendly as we practically can be while taking into account the continued interest that the city has in maintaining a certain degree of architectural integrity to our downtown and the area and the areas of historical concern in the city. So that's so you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're thinking about. The CRA districts are worth looking at. You know, one of the things that Randy brings to the table is some history with dealing with both of these and a definite expertise that we don't have in-house. So I don't know that we have, with that sort of background, you know, is it appropriate for us to, you know, set Randy loose here?
Yeah, I think you can.
Right. I mean, we would need a contract.
Get a proposal.
A proposal and a contract. But,
and make a recommendation.
My point is, I think the next step would be
I think
hits.
As a committee, you could vote to recommend that, and then at council,
okay.
You could
vote
do that.
To recommend that we get a proposal from Randy.
Mm-hmm. And then at the council meeting on the 3rd, you can report that, and we'll have Randy's proposal for approval.
Great. Are we good with it conceptually? Any thoughts on that? Then I would move that we request that we get a formal proposal from Pogemeyer to assist us in this process of consolidating our design standards within the city, taking into account, which would also take into account a review of the boundaries of our various overlay districts, so that we could consider entering into a contract with Pogemeyer to move forward with this process.
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay.
So a question just to clarify, and we're talking about both the ordinance and the design guidelines.
Right.
So updating both.
Right.
Okay. I would just in terms of the content of the proposal, I suggest that we connect with the downtown plan and specifically include some participation from, I think many of you remember Ted Creer coming from Land Design Studio and doing the presentation. Mm-hmm. He did a number of building renovations, building rethinking some of the building facades, repurposing some of the buildings, we can include that into the design guidelines and connect more directly with the downtown.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that. A question for Doug, is there any connection here between this and the discussion we just had in our Economic Development Subcommittee regarding the downtown plan? I mean, what relevance does what he just said?
And our SOMO development?
Yeah.
And how we're going, and how we're going to be involved.
I mean, I think there should be some coordination with what Kevin is going to come back with us for within December. You know, so there should be some conversation at least about this.
I think that's exactly right. I think reaching out to JJR, for example, and some of the building massing that they did in the SOMO concepts that we saw.
Yeah. What you missed, I think, in the previous meeting was that council is very interested in hearing from the administration about a downtown plan, Main Street plan, okay, whether that would be a tree, you know, foliage-driven plan or a streetscape-driven plan. And the administration is going to come back to council at our meeting, first meeting in December, with sort of a critical path of how to approach that, ultimately leading to some sort of a process. So I would encourage you and Kevin to have some conversation about that.
Sounds good.
Okay. Item one, I think we've completed. All right, so we'll move on to the second issue for today, which is consideration of the issue of charity huts, donation bins. They come under different names. This came up. We've had a fair amount of email traffic about this. It's originated as a result of a initial concern brought by one of our neighbors, and I will be. I'll admit I really hadn't noticed the proliferation of the collection bins, donation bins in our community until I got the email that reminded me of a road trip that I took with my daughter, who was playing softball at the time, through southeastern Michigan on the way to Adrian, and I saw number of very provocative political signs that said Joe Smith is for guns. And on the way up there, I saw these signs all over the place, and I got up to up there and up to the softball tournament and made mention of it to some of the other parents who didn't see any of them. And I realized that my political focus on yard signs over the years drew my attention to those yard signs, but most people didn't see them. And that may be the same with these donation bins. People may not have seen them, but now that I've been looking for them, they are proliferating in our community. We have a lot of them around, and they do raise, I think, some legitimate public health and safety issues. They come in dramatically different shapes, sizes, construction materials. Some of them I could see conceivably posing fire risks, safety risks in terms of stability and safety going forward. They obviously become potential blight issues. There are aesthetic issues associated with them. At the end of the day, I think it would be, having now identified this as an issue, I think it would be a mistake for us not to address them specifically in our zoning code at some point. I think as an initial matter, I think the there is a sign aspect to these charity bins that I think maybe is not, was not in our initial upfront thinking about them, but that clearly applies. They clearly meet the definition of sign, but we really don't have a mechanism in our sign code to address them, short of not permitting them at all. Because if we were to apply our sign code to the bins, there are really no provisions in our sign code that would allow them to be permitted. Our sign code is really designed to permit signs associated with activities that are conducted on the specific property by the specific property owner or lessee. Secondary and third-party uses are not permitted. You can't permit off-site third-party signs. These bins are kind of unusual in that respect because they are ancillary uses, and we really don't have a provision in our sign code to permit ancillary uses. So just looking at our code right now, I think our sign code would prohibit the installation of these bins or charity huts or donation bins on any property in the city currently. So that leaves us with really, I think, two options, or maybe three. One, we could do nothing and just say these structures violate our sign code and you got to get them out of here because we can't permit them. The second option, and I think something that I was sort of initially leaning towards, was just banning them all outright. Just saying, you know, we don't want these in our city. There are a number of cities around Ohio, including Rossford in our immediate vicinity, that have taken that tact. I'm not sure in the long run. My thinking on that has evolved to some extent. My current thinking is that if a property owner has an interest in promoting or using one of these, that with an appropriate degree of regulation, you know, we might want to leave that to the individual property owner to make their own decision about how to use their property. Obviously, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about this. I had the opportunity last week to meet with Mr. Hinderleiter and another individual from his organization. I've looked at a number of ordinances, including six ordinances that Planet Aid provided me of regulation. I looked at a couple ordinances that Leslie provided me. And some of the typical things that are included in regulations of these ancillary uses are limits on the distance or the number of these units that could be on any given property, property size limits, property use limits. Vacant properties are frequently not included in properties that would be eligible to host these. They have to be sufficiently large enough to host them. We would require, they generally require that the bins be serviced on some regular basis and that the bins not be overfilled. And if they are overfilled, that they have somebody from the city notifies them, they have a very short period of time to respond. But even with that, maybe a weekly service requirement. There are safety issues, sometimes specifying the types of bins, the materials, the size of the bins, some designation on the donation bins of whether they are for profit or, because a number of them are, the secondary clothing, secondary textile market is a significant economic market. And even those that that are not for profit, there's a significant economic way of doing that. You know, for the traditional that I was more familiar with, the Goodwill operation where they donate clothes and turn around and sell them, they too sell clothes into a secondary market. But these collection bins predominantly collect the clothing and sell the clothing into the secondary market, then use the proceeds from that sale to fund their charitable organizations, their charitable activities. In addition to Planet Aid, was contacted by Ohio Mills, who is very active apparently in supporting Special Olympics. And I got some letters from the Special Olympics folks, you know, who were interested in seeing us regulate as opposed to banning these. Annual registration, fees associated with that annual registration, penalties that specify that non-compliant bins can be impounded with additional fees to recover the bins, and an acknowledgement that after a period of time, the city can sell, recycle, scrap, or dispose of the bins as they deem appropriate. And in the event that there are any proceeds from those activities, that the city would keep those proceeds. I mean, those are all the types of things that are included in regulations. The other thing that is pretty common in the regulations is a limitation on the number of charity huts or bins that could be located on any one property. If you notice at Starlight Plaza or behind Kroger's, you know, they have a behind the Kroger on Sylvania, you know, there's a lineup of them. Generally, that would not be permitted under the sample ordinances that I reviewed. At the end of the day, I think what we're looking at is really an initial decision of whether we want to regulate these bins with the understanding that any regulation would require the express approval of the property owner to place one of these bins on their properties, or whether we want to take the honestly more simple a regulatory approach of banning them, but realizing that those have impacts on not just the charitable organizations or the businesses that run these bins, but also on the property uses of our neighbors. Late today, before we came here, I think I had previously circulated a proposed, what a ban kind of piece of legislation would look like. I circulated later today, and I know you probably didn't get to see it because I think I sent it before I left downtown to come out to the meeting. But I circulated a what a regulatory scheme might look like. You know, we're probably not going to decide this one way or another today, but I did want to introduce what I think are the options, which are either we're going to have them and regulate them or not have them. I don't think we're going to leave the cowboy land that we currently have in place going forward. I don't think that's prudent. Okay, so I've talked a lot. Sandy, you look like you're ready to
say something.
very important. I just have a question. So the bins that we see out there right now, the property owners haven't necessarily said that they're okay to be on their properties?
That is correct.
Okay, and number two, so therefore, the bin placement doesn't require the property owner to say okay, or the property owner gets no benefit financially from having a bin on their property.
Well, I can tell, yeah.
Correct?
I can address all those because I've been looking into this. There are different models that different folks use, okay? And from my discussions with Mr. Hinderleiter, I think Planet Aid is pretty responsible in terms of dealing with property owners. They get agreements with the property owners to place their bins. They have both compensated bin placements and uncompensated bin placements. Depending, I suppose, on the property owner and the desirability of the location. Some of the other operators apparently are not so genteel. They just plop their bins down wherever they can get away with it. I have some anecdotal stories about property owners requesting that the bins be removed, and they're not getting removed. Part of that's because if you think about where these things are, a lot of them are in shopping centers where the owner is, you know, not maybe as diligent in policing his property, or where you have a diligent presence like a company like Kroger, but the actual underlying property, Kroger's a lessee, and maybe the underlying property where the bins are located may or may not be covered by the lease. That's, you know, and behind Kroger, you know, they have a number of recycling bins associated that Lucas County operates out there. And those bins are placed right, you know, adjacent to those. I have my anecdotal research suggests that some of those bins were not placed with anybody's approval or permission. They were just put there. I don't know that. I haven't initiated my subpoena powers to figure that out. But I think that's consistent with the way they look too. So one of the things that if we were just to prosecute these as sign code violations, the burden for that falls on the property owner, who in this instance doesn't even want, you know, may not even know that the thing is there. So I think it makes sense for us to address these specifically in our code one way or the other, either with an express prohibition or with a regulatory aspect to it, so that we can feel comfortable that we can address these bins without imposing a lot of expense and cost on our on the property owner without any who may not have wanted this problem in the first place. I know Mary's unable to be here today, but that was one of her concerns about just moving forward with this, with the position that, well, these are a violation of the sign code, get them out of there. You know, we're really at that point imposing the entirety of the problem on the property owner, and we really haven't addressed that appropriately. So I think in order for, as council members, to be good neighbors to our businesses, I think it makes sense that we address these in an intelligent fashion going forward.
I have a question. Do you have, how many other organizations are out there? There's Planet Aid. How many other have you noticed, like 10 or 100 or?
Well, I can't say I've done a comprehensive survey of them in the city, but I can think of seven or eight right off the top of my head that I've seen in the bins that we've seen, and there are, and I don't know, I assume there are lots of them.
Well, one of the problems we have in Northern Ohio is that there's a proliferation of John Q. Public, who was up in the garage, and he takes some plate board, and he makes up a box, and paints it red, and puts it out, or red, or orange, or white. And that's a problem very unique to this neighborhood. We don't have that in Michigan. I don't have it in South Bend. I don't have it in Indianapolis. But Northern Ohio, we have a lot of these, basically, flake board boxes. Number one, they're fire traps. Number two, the guy might only have three or four. So there could be dozens of people that are doing this. The problem, I guess you might say, is a national type company like Planet Aid. There are only two or three of us that are national and are nonprofits, first of all. And I've been at it for almost 20 years. I mean, we're very, very rich. And we've been through this. I've been through this. This is all I do. I've been through this with many, many good councils. I can tell you personally, I have the utmost respect for Sylvania. I'm born and raised in Detroit, so I've known you guys for a long time. We will do anything we can to help you. My suggestion in brief is that you pursue the third option, which is ordinance. Some ordinance that controls the boxes. So the boxes, the industry is under the control of the city. And, on that type of basis, you will find that most of the boxes will disappear automatically. In the city of Portage, which is about the same size as Sylvania, there were probably 35 boxes. And that's the first city where we actually, with help of some legal counsel that we acquired in Detroit, helped them put together an ordinance, a copy of which you guys now have. It's very, very restrictive. Of these 35 boxes, I think there are only 12 or 13 boxes left in Portage now, and 12 of them are Planet Aid boxes, because we will abide by whatever ordinance the city puts together. We have approximately 10 to 12 boxes in Sylvania now. And of course, we have a contract with Stop and Go and the markets and all that stuff. So we have more boxes we could put out, but have not put out, kind of holding all in advance while we work through this thing together. Our land use council in Detroit, Dan Dalton, a lot of times what he will do is if you wish, once you've prepared something, and there's a question, is this really constitutional, is this really illegal? And I think that's the key, that's the bottom line. We're in court right now with St. John's, Michigan, and Township of Ypsilanti, and believe me, we don't want to do this. It's expensive for them, it's expensive for us. We don't want to do it, and because it's a federal court issue. So, and I'm not an attorney, so just bear with me. So I would suggest that you consider putting together an ordinance. We will help you however, any way we can. Come to meetings, answer phone calls, whatever, we'll help you. And if you wish, we'll get Dan involved, because that is his specialty. Other than that, and not to embarrass Councilman, but Brian Hinderreiter is our branch manager.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
You're
and
Bob.
I'm Bob Thompson.
It's Bob Thompson.
I'm the foot soldier. So I'm the messenger that always gets killed by the king.
Now see, and I have a practice of marking these cards when I get them, and okay. This is one of those instances where I got two cards at the same time and I got them mixed up. So I'm sorry, Bob.
I
apologize.
I don't mean to embarrass you.
I'm not. Well, believe me, you have to do a lot. You got to go a lot further to do that. And I just note that and this is worth noting. Okay, this is a big business too. This is not the litigation that's gone up in Ypsilanti has not been hasn't been cheap to defend. I think ultimately I am very comfortable that if as a public safety matter we want to ban these, we can ban them. I am 100% comfortable that under the Ohio Constitution and as a home rule jurisdiction, we have the authority to ban these if we want to ban them to promote public health and safety. Even the safest box raises a certain degree of public safety issues going forward that we're empowered to address. Having said that, I've sort of come around to the idea that regulation allows the individual property owner to make a decision about whether they want to have one of these on their property, one of these on their property, not eight of them, but one of these on their property, and rather that the charitable benefits associated with that warrant, you know, going through the regulatory process to make sure that the public health and safety interest that we have as a community gets addressed, but nevertheless recognizing that there can be some benefits to those.
Doug, in all of your research, I heard Mr. Johnson say that they have 10 or 12 bins currently in Sylvania. I don't know if that's city of Sylvania or township, but my point is, do we want to limit the number that a organization have in our city? We don't have a very big city, and only one on a property, if, you know, it got to be a big thing. I mean, we could still see them, several within a block on a main drag. I guess maybe I'm looking at, okay, if we're not going to ban them, could we say a certain number within our city limits? Is that constitutional?
There are a couple of ways this is generally done. One is by limiting the number that can be with limiting the number per parcel, limiting how close they can be together. But the other thing that I interjected in the and again, this is a draft that I put together mostly last night while I was watching the World Series game, so it needs more work, okay? But I involved our architectural review committee, so that there could be a consideration of aesthetics and location in that. And that's one of the things that probably needs to be beefed up, honestly, in the draft that I set up. But in terms of the number in the community, I haven't seen that sort of, you know, numerical limitation generally in the sample regulations that I saw, that I've reviewed. Doesn't mean we couldn't do it, because DeSandy, you're smarter than most other city councils anyway, so if that's something we need, we can do that. But at the end of the day, I think one of the things I did want to interject there was, you know, a human element of review that I think we get in the architectural review committee that maybe goes beyond just the black and white. Just what's permitted is permitted, but it's also subject to review by those five appointees of council who we entrust with all kinds of judgments about building standards and building designs, and letting them, and signs, you know, for example, and giving them a degree of review of that. So that's not a direct answer. The direct answer to your question is, I haven't seen specific number limitations. That's certainly something we could think about.
Doug, if I may, a couple comments. I think something else that we may want to consider, not just the limitation, but since there is a, for lack of a better term, enforcement factor that would necessarily need to go through any sort of zoning guidelines, because this is something that's, it's not like a facade on a building or a sign. There's going to be an ongoing maintenance component to having staff members look at after these things to make sure that they're not getting overcrowded periodically. Is that a safe assessment, Kevin? That there needs to be some sort of a financial component some way or another to potentially be considered there, whether it's a deposit to make sure that they do what they say they're going to do, maybe like a water deposit that gets refunded if they've shown, that they're, you know, taking good care of the box. The other question is, do we have a public policy decision to make based upon whether we just let Billy Bob Box Incorporated put one of these out there, or do they need to fund or help provide some benefit for some entity like Special Olympics or some other charitable organization? And if so, then the last question is, okay, so you made $1 million and you threw 50 bucks in the hat to Charity A, is that enough?
Okay, well, interestingly enough, those issues have come up before. A lot of communities limit the ability to register these to not-for-profit corporations. I don't know if that's constitutional or not, but that would certainly be something that I would propose we include until somebody told us it wasn't. I mean, I think it probably is appropriate to say, you know, overall balancing act, that we would allow this ancillary use for charitable purposes, but not for profit, uses. I think we could prevail on that, but I'm not entirely clear on that. But I do know that most of these communities that have regulated these have limited them to not-for-profit use. So we will be in good company on that topic. That's the first thing I'd note. The second thing is that there are two models, I think, of dealing with dealing with the costs associated with monitoring these. The one that I put in the existing draft is a annual fee. It's an annual permit that you have to get. So annually, you have to cough up a certain amount of money to the city to have the bins, which would contribute towards the enforcement of the zoning code. I don't know that it would cover it, but it would certainly contribute to it. And then I also included a provision, which is common, in which if you have a bin that is non-compliant, either because it's not permitted or because it's in bad shape, that the city can impound the bin. And if they impound the bin, have an additional impoundment fee and storage fee and a re-permitting fee to address those enforcement issues. So, you know, Kevin, I know Kevin hasn't had a chance to look at what I put together because I sent out, I think, 338.
Impounding the bin means pulling it off the parking lot.
Right? Absolutely.
And they're huge. Could we physically do that? Do we have a truck that could do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like you need like a front loader or something.
Yeah.
Believe me, Kevin could get it done if we needed to. The issue is whether he wants to take that on. So, you know, those are...
You might have been thinking about storing them in your backyard.
Right, right. Yeah, we're not going to impound them at 4336 Tamworth. Although there are enough leaves in my cul-de-sac right now, I'd take up the same amount of space as a bin. Anyway, and they're in the street, Sandy. I was shocked. Anyway, but I think going forward, what I'd really like to do, or I'd like as council to do, is start thinking through these issues a little more. So I'm not the only one that's thinking about them. Take a look at the proposed ordinances that have circulated, and I will share, Bob, with you the draft that I've put together and with the guy from Ohio Mills and with my neighbor who got this whole thing started and get some input from those folks, and then we'll come back. We'll either come back with another committee meeting, or depending on the sense of if we're all good good with regulating these, maybe we'll have Leslie start on some legislation. Mark?
Yeah, I just have a couple of points. Certainly, as we collect our information, I hope we can include in the information loop some of the key property owners that are either being, are either profiting from or being victimized by these huts. You know, I don't know if it's appropriate to have Bill or Joe Shaw or somebody reach out to some folks that we know are the major landowners where these sites are. You know, I think we know who owns the site where Kroger is located in Sylvania. We know who owns the Starlight, ProMedico owns the Starlight Plaza site now, right? So, you know, we just need to kind of understand whether, what their attitude is about these things, what are the issues that are important to them, and fold that in. And I think at the same time, when we do have a piece of legislation that we think as a committee we're all comfortable with, let's make sure that we have some public involvement there.
Yeah,
of course.
We have a process. We'll have a process.
Yeah, because
we would refer, you know, anything that we come up here,
right,
would go to the Planning Commission. They'd have to review it. We'd have to have a public hearing on it. I mean, it's a,
okay,
you know, as part of the zoning code, we've got, you know, there's going to be more opportunities for interested folks to comment on these, whatever we do going forward. Whether we decide to ban them or regulate them, either way, we have, as part of our zoning code amendment process, we're going to have that.
Yeah, and I'd be very interested to quantify this notion of how many of these are nonprofit and how many are for-profit, right? I mean, I don't think that this community has a place for for-profit charity huts unless we're prepared to treat them like a business, right, and regulate them like a business. But the nonprofit's a little different matter, but I think that would be an important piece of information for me.
Yeah, well, you know, and I looking at the ones behind Kroger.
Mm. Well, the ones behind,
which
behind
is a drive-by. I'm going to drive. I think I doubt that any of those are. I wonder whether any of those are for. Are.
Now, behind Kroger, you mean where the county bins are?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a bunch of. There's a bunch of them in front, too, right?
I think those got moved.
Did they?
I think Kroger moved those at their expense.
Okay.
Because they couldn't get anybody else to move them. And they couldn't get rid of them. I suspect those are all for profit.
Well, it's maybe we could find out.
Doug, are we talking about commercial property owners, not residential property
owners?
In my
regulation, I limit it to B1B, B1, B2, M1, M2. I think that's it. So no residential. I'm sorry?
Otherwise, you could make your garage one.
Right. Yeah, no, they're just commercial properties. And I think I included, if I didn't, we will, no vacant properties. They have to otherwise be.
That's a very good point, by the way, including.
Yeah, because we don't want one on a, I mean, it's not in the city, but across from CVS on that nice clear piece of property that now that those homes are there, I wouldn't want to see a collection bin there.
So your proposal is that we sort of let this continue to percolate.
I'd like you to take a look at the legislation, and if you have any specific thoughts, maybe get back to the author, and we can figure and I'll work with Leslie to see whether I'm. As you sit here today, if the members of the committee have a thought, regulation versus ban, I'd be interested, you know, if you've already reached a conclusion about that. Like I said, I've been into this a little more, but I'm kind of leaning towards the regulation as opposed to the ban.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from the property owners about that.
Okay. We'll see what we can do about getting some property owner input on that. Leslie.
Mr. Lukey, I do know that Mr. Sanford did have a discussion with the Kroger property owner, and they are very interested in any way the city can assist, either with regulation or banning. They have had...
Do they see it as a nuisance?
They see it as a nuisance, and they've had no success in getting any response from almost any of the companies. The only one that did respond was Goodwill, and actually Goodwill is the one who contacted Mr. Sanford to complain that they were the only ones that removed theirs, and they felt like they were being penalized.
If we could maybe duplicate that conversation across two or three other owners,
sure,
that would be really helpful.
Yep.
If there's a consensus, it starts to make it kind of a no-brainer.
Right, right.
And I don't think we have one at Kroger's, because that's very...
No, I don't think you do either.
The return is so minimal, it isn't worth the fuel that it takes to go and check the box, so we just wouldn't put one where there's only one box.
Doug, do we have a time frame that you'd like to have us get back to and have this kind of take to the next phase?
Monday? No, I'm... Well, realistically, if we're gonna task Mr. Stanford to contact some of these other owners, it's gonna be a couple of weeks. Yeah, I think what should we schedule another meeting?
A single issue meeting where we can talk about this. Yeah.
Okay.
2-3 weeks out.
All right, let's touch base with Mr. Stanford about what he think, what time frame he needs, and we can set another meeting next Monday. How's that? Rather than trying to do it today. Yes?
One last thing. Do we have, in your proposed ordinance, is there control over where the bin can be put on the property so we're not obstructing?
A site plan requirement is included in that. Okay, let's move on. Just briefly, you want to talk about zoning fees, Kevin?
We've taken a look at some of our zoning fees. Many of these have been adjusted for 10 years plus.
Sorry, Bob. I apologize about the name.
We contacted about seven area communities and gotten some of their fee structures, and what we put together is a recommended fee structure based on those inquiries and based on what we had existing. Doug, you'll notice on your board BZA that I modified that.
Yep.
To cover. Some of the fees that we have aren't... Mr. Fry mentioned earlier, you know, there are certain administrative costs and things of that nature associated with something. And some of these fees that, as they exist, don't cover those costs. We have people that have to attend meetings that are paid extra for attending those meetings. Some of the advertisements that we have to make, one that we just recently did for the Sylvania Country Club, that advertisement was $750.
Can we pay for that?
Yes, we do. Yeah, currently we pay for that.
We're going to change that.
That was a very high one, in all honesty. That's kind of abnormal. Most of them are in the 90 to 125 range. That legal description was extremely long, and so that's why it was so high.
Nonetheless, it's the principle.
It's the principle. If someone's asking for a special consideration or a special service, my belief is that they should pay that cost. And so that's what some of these fees address. We have some plan review fees and plat review fees proposed that we have not had in the past, and almost every other entity does. And so we're proposing that we put those in. So quickly, you know, from the service is on the left there, and then the average of the area communities that we surveyed is the next column, what we currently have, and then what we are proposing the fee to be. And, you know, I'll just leave it at that. If any of you have any questions or comments, you know, feel free to call me or whatever. But at some point, we'd like to move forward and modify our fee structure.
And Kevin, we have council will have to, would have to adopt this fee structure, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so what I would suggest is that, look these over. If you have a specific concern, bring them up. Otherwise, I think I'd suggest that we have Leslie prepare legislation for our next council meeting so we can implement these. They're probably long overdue.
Yep.
One small question. Do you have a sense, Kevin, how much incremental revenue would be derived from this?
I have not taken a look at it.
$5,000 a year, $10,000 a year, do we get from zoning?
Yeah, I think we're probably looking at $5,000, between $5,000 to $10,000. Right. Yeah, it's, you know, many of these fees aren't anything that is going to save our budget, but I think it's truing up the cost of doing business.
So a sense of proportionality.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the key here is these fees are for where people are specifically asking for the city to be involved in their development and land use. So, and so all we're really asking is that people come closer to covering the cost of their request of the special use of the city. These are not, typical regulatory enforcement matters in the most part. So this is sort of a theory. You know, we don't always do this, but it is sort of a user pays sort of thought process here. And so I think it's very defensible to make these more consistent with what our costs are, at least get it closer to that. Okay. With that, Leslie, you have 2 minutes to talk about...
Thank you, Mr. Hino. I will use them wisely.
Satellite dishes. Now, you may before we go in, you may recall we've talked about satellite dishes when we redid the zoning code, and we decided at that point, and I know it was not easy. We decided to allow small satellite dishes in front yards because, in some instances, that was the only place you could put them. Leslie, you want to tell us what
That's
problem
correct.
That has
there is a there is an issue with a company. The property owner has requested it be on the roof, but our code, I'll just read you this sentence really quickly, and it's Kevin and I's recommendation that we just delete the unless part of the sentence. It just says that in residential districts, such dishes and antennas shall be located only on a roof or in rear or side yards. We'd like to put a period there, but in our code it continues on, unless such restriction precludes reception of an acceptable quality signal. It's, I think some of the companies now are just taking the easy way out and putting them on a stake in the front yard. They just don't want their people climbing the roofs. And the property owners also don't want them on a stake in the front yard. They would prefer them on the roof, but they get into a fight with a company because our code allows them to be on a stake in the front yard.
But if they could put it on the roof and get a good signal.
I'm not a satellite technician, but I believe in all cases, if you can put it on the ground and get a good signal, you can put it on the roof and get a good signal.
Okay, well, I mean, we added that language. I mean, we thought about that language, and we added it because we thought it was an issue.
And I also remember the discussions, but I think now the companies are just trying to not do what their customer wants.
Well, maybe we could go cite a few in the front yard that, because that's the homeowner, though, who gets cited.
I hate to be a cynic.
Yeah.
Isn't it cheaper for these companies to put them in the front yard?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Exactly.
The code does not allow them to be in the front yard.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's my point. That's our point. Yeah.
It doesn't
but
now.
But they are clinging to that unless part that says that if the signal can't be received except for there, so they're saying, well, we can't get the signal up there, so we have to put it there. Exactly. That's just the proposal. You can think about it. We don't need a decision today.
Okay. Well, no, I'm a Buckeye guy, so, you know, I mean, I'd be happy that I'm not opposed to removing it, but isn't, I mean, they can't put it there now.
It's an enforcement issue.
Right.
Right.
And then it puts the, it puts us in the middle of the company and the property owner, and it's just kind of, we've had it a couple of times over the last period of time, which is why we brought it to you to discuss something about it.
Who, is this just Dish that we're dealing with?
I think.
As a company so far that we had to deal with. There's one on Gainesville, I apologize, but I don't know if it's us. There's one.
Can't we write them a letter and say, hey, you know, this isn't?
We've met with them.
Oh.
He, the address on Gainesville, they took the position, we had no choice, we can't get a signal in place else.
Who is that, the owner or the company?
The company.
Dish company.
Because the owner on Gainesville.
Okay, well, is that true?
Well, we don't know. I'd have to go out there and.
Well, I mean, that was, that's why we had that exception in there.
If a Dish company is telling me that's the only place he can get a signal, what am I going to do to refute it?
Well, okay, but. But then don't, but then, so we're just going to tell that homeowner they can't have satellite television?
Or go with a different company that can get their satellite location on the backside of their house.
Well, we just don't believe them is where we're coming from.
I have no way to refute it. Maple Drive, there was another one. We stopped and talked to the homeowner. The homeowner said, thank God, I got a reason to get them out. Dish tried to fight, they didn't want it there either. And Dish tried to fight it. The homeowner finally said, get it out of here. So they removed that.
It's a pattern of behavior by Dish.
So a couple of just follow-up questions. So Aunt Susie, the homeowner's got one in her front yard now. We pass this ordinance now. What for Aunt Susie?
That's, right now, to my knowledge, we only have one. So
only Aunt Susie, you mean? One homeowner?
Yep.
Okay.
To my knowledge.
So this isn't, we don't have 3 dozen of these hanging around the city that are going to have to remove them and put them on a roof, correct?
Let me write Dish and tell them that we're going to presume that they can get a satellite signal on a roof or in a backyard unless they can affirmatively prove it. And I'd be more than happy to amend the code to make it enforceable against the against the person that installs the dish.
Well, let me go a step further. I understand that you don't want to restrict properties, but do we want these dishes in everybody's front yard?
No.
I don't think that we want that.
Can't we just get rid of the loophole? If there's a problem that it truly is a problem for them to get signal, they can come to us and we can talk about it. But right now we're allowing the company to use the loophole that we created.
Well, we're
uncreated.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're the ones that are allowing it by not enforcing the code. Okay, well, I don't care. What are the people on Gainesville are fine with this too.
They weren't as successful with Dish, but the people on Maple, I don't know if it's two different installers what the deal was, but people on Maple said get it out of here.
I would be willing to make a motion that we recommend to council to prepare legislation to amend this as requested by the law.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, so Leslie, let's prepare the legislation to refer it to the Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do that by Monday or not?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure, she says. I don't have anything else to do except draft legislation for Mr. Hanum. Okay.
So Leslie Brand, Trump, Plan A.
All right, I think we've covered a lot.
Good meeting.
It was a good meeting. Thank you. Thank you for indulging a heavy agenda. With that, I move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor, aye. Aye, we stand adjourned. At 6:26.